This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Unfortunately, today I've got a bit of a cold, which is why I sound so funny. If you can forgive that, you can also go and find us on social media. I'm at Jay Beardmore. This podcast is at Rugby Dungeon. And of course, there is Egg Chasers with me, Tim and Phil, every Sunday without fail for the last 5 years, if you want to know about the World Cup and the Premiership and all that nonsense. But I have a very special guest, usually found in the middle of a rugby field. It's JP Doyle. How are you, JP?
Hey, JP. Thanks for having me on. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, it feels like we've been trying to catch up with each other for about a year and a half now.
Yeah. Well, it's just referees are best kept in the background, aren't they? dark ages.
So what have you been up to today?
I've been square-eyed looking at games. So I'm involved with coaching of a couple of the referees. So we had to. I obviously had my games from the weekend, and today's Wednesday. So I was washing up all the games that I was involved in the championship. I had three games I was involved in the championship to review and do a bit of coaching. And then one of the guys, he's a school teacher, he's one of the part-timers. So he came over this afternoon and we had a coaching session this morning. I had training and then this evening before bed, my training again.
That's interesting because we spoke last week and I think you said you were watching, I want to say Wharfdale. It wasn't Wharfdale, someone in the Midlands. Who on earth were you watching?
Chinner, was it the Chinner game?
Chinner, that was the one.
Yeah, it was a National One game I was watching.
And I was thinking, why on earth are you watching Chinner? So were you watching the game or were you watching another official?
I was watching one of the refs I was working with and she was just back from sevens. So she was then moving into doing a championship game the following week. So it was a good chance for her to get up to speed and get her bits and pieces done before she went into the championship.
Wow. So how do you go about analysing a ref's performance then? Because that's obviously a bit different from what most people are doing when they're analysing games.
Yeah, it's so my background is teaching before refereeing. So I kind of take that approach where I would ask the referee to look at two or three things that they can do in the game that's away from what the players are going to produce. So you can't ask them not to be offside or not to fail to roll away, but perhaps you can look at the way in which you set up the scrum. Perhaps you can look at the way in which you manage offside lines, the way in which you referee line breaks, or the way in which around the goal line, or how you deal with your team of three when under pressure. And instead of reviewing the whole game, you can just take those couple of bits, focus on that, so that the performer has a bit of control over what they're doing. And then, of course, you have the wider audit of the game. Look, what did you get right? What did you get wrong? What were the big moments? But the game provides you with them rather than you being in control of that. You can't control those things.
That's really interesting. So have I got this right? On Mondays, do all the refs get together? Or is that your day to assess your game?
Best example I can give you this week, I did a game in the Premiership on Sunday. I ran touch on Saturday in Manchester, and then on Sunday I had a game I was refereeing in Wasps. So on Monday we had to go, we were in for about 11 o'clock, but by then you kind of need to have seen your game. So I had two games to watch before 11 o'clock on Monday morning.
Wow.
Even with the two games we had at the weekend, obviously being the World Cup, we're a bit short-staffed with some of the guys over there. And then on Monday we go in and we have training. And then we have game reviews with a coach who would have been either at the game or already reviewed it. And then we have wrap-up sessions on all six games in the Premiership together. And then Tuesday is a longer day. We're in around 7:30 in the morning because we're all located down at Twickenham, so we can start nice and early. And we work till about 4:30, where we have a couple of training sessions, a fitness session, a weight session, a swimming session.
What?
And interspersed, we'll have coaching sessions. We'll also focus on, let's look at all the scrums from the six games in the Premiership, or let's look at all the failed mauls, or let's look at all the foul play. We'll have two or three kind of hot topics that we'll look at each week and move on to the next week that way.
Now, I mean, I knew that you're all professionals, and I knew you did a lot of work. I had no idea that it was that intense.
Yeah, but like, intense is a relative word. It's just a working day, isn't it? It's what you guys do, is what everyone else does out there. It's just,
well, I mean, I don't have swim sessions to sell pensions.
Well, there are swim terms in a very loose set selection of words. There's a couple of us who are ex-swimmers, so we do a bit, but a lot of them are just running up and down the pool stretching. So some of them are in the hot tub. So I wouldn't be feeling too sorry for any referee. Not that anyone would, but.
Okay, so once you've done yours, do all the Premiership referees then look after other refs, or is that just something which you're doing on the side?
I think because I'm getting bloody old now, I have the opportunity to pass on my useful or useless tips to some of the people who are coming through younger, and we work in pods. So there's sort of decanting of information downwards. But it depends on where you are in your refereeing career to who and what you'd be looking at. But even referees on the way through can still mentor referees at level 4 or level 5 or level 6, 7, 8, even referees starting. So there's always, you should always be a sharing of information, because we're a small little geeky, weird world. We do need to help each other out, and you can't always have coaches come to every game. So even if you're a starting ref, let's say you're doing, I don't know, London level 8, you still need someone to help you to say, look, maybe try this, or maybe stand there, or wouldn't it be better if you stood on this side of the scrum to see what the scrum halves are doing, or whatever it may be. Someone has to teach you, and I think that's a large part of what our role is and what we should be wanting to do.
Now, just going off topic, I've literally just thought of this now. Does it amaze you when you hear about things like, for instance, the NFL officials all still being part-time, considering the amount of time that you guys put into the sport?
Yeah, they are part-time. I think they've gone full-time in the last 18 months, the NFL officials.
I thought they went on strike over that. I thought they didn't do it at the end.
They did, and then they're pretty well paid, those NFL officials. Look, everybody wants to be paid more. I'm sure they do too. But the fee they get is quite hard, and they work as a unit. But again, their season is only 16, or I think it's 18 regular.
Yeah, something like that.
So, which they play 16 games. And then if they're in the knockouts, there's 4 more games they can do. So you take a rugby season, which is 11 months for a referee. The NFL season runs from preseason for them runs end of August, and then Super Bowl is second or third week of February, I believe. So it's quite a short season.
Yeah, do you know what? I think a lot of those guys might do basketball too, and not top level basketball, but I think they go from drug football to basketball.
A lot of them, and they might do hockey, or you know, they are baseball. They're almost professional zebras. Yeah.
So just give me a bit of background about yourself. I mean, obviously you've got that strong, is it Birmingham accent or Liverpool accent there?
No, not quite. Dublin, obviously. Except Dublin accent, yeah.
So how have you ended up refereeing in the Premiership? What was your route into this profession?
I my father was a referee, but that's kind of not how I got in. That's kind of the simple story. My dad was a ref, so I refed. I was playing in Ireland in a club called Turner College. And I was playing for my university team on weekends. I could play 2 games a week back then. A lot of people, I think people still do it.
Yeah.
It was no problem. But I suffered a pretty hefty back injury where I had a couple of spinal fusions. And it took me a couple of years to come back. And playing more than one game was really difficult. So when I came to England to go to St. Mary's College, which is the teaching college in Strawberry Hill, Twickenham, I would play on a Wednesday for my university team. But then it was too difficult to play. And so I tried playing for local clubs on a Saturday they give you 50 quid or 60 quid, maybe if you play at a reasonable level, they give you a few quid. But I found that very difficult. So I started refereeing because they give you 20, 30 quid and a few beers. And that seemed it's pretty easy to do. You could do, I don't know, London Nigerians versus London Cornish.
Yeah.
Third. And you'd have a brilliant time. You'd have just the best day out. You'd have four or five beers and they'd give you 25 quid and you had a great day. They had a great day and there was no hassle. And that's kind of how I got into it. And then as bad as a ref I may be, I was a worse player and I decided to stick with being a bad ref.
So, I mean, you've obviously got a love of the game. And yeah. What I really struggled with, I mean, even when I've reffed two games, a dreadful standard, and I've run touch, and every time that I do any sort of officiating, the biggest problem I have is I can't help but watch the game and forget that I'm actually running it. I can't imagine how hard it would be doing that in the Premiership with the quality of the standard.
Oh yeah, like I caught myself at the weekend, one of the tries in the corner, I started laughing when I saw it on the screen because the finish was so sublime. I was like, oh, I even said on the telly, holy moly, I looked at it to take something stronger, because it's what some of these guys can do, even from a neutral point of view watching it, it takes your breath away and you admire it and go, my golly, and then you switch back into referee mode. But, you know, there are players out there, and that's the best seat in the house. That's the great thing about refereeing, is you see and even if you're refereeing, say, I don't know, a school's under 14 game, you see wonderful rugby players, children, doing wonderful things on the pitch that brings them great joy. And you can kind of have a residual joy off that. And that's how you get into refereeing. That's why you love it. Because there's a slight arrogance if you think to yourself, I want to referee this game because I want to make this the best game that these children or these players or these club guys can have. They're going to have the best day because I'm here refereeing this. Not I'm going to referee this game so well, but I really want whoever I'm here with, I want them to have a great day, because if they have a really good day, I'll have a really good day, and won't that be wonderful? And that's kind of the great thing about refereeing, that you see around the clubs on a Sunday morning, that you see in the local leagues, my local club, Teddington, you see it with the Teddington firsts or seconds or thirds, they're having a great time. And that's rugby, and that's why we love it.
That's interesting. I've always wondered why a referee would become a referee. And here's my thinking, because I had this a long conversation with Tim Cocker from HGS. I assume you know Tim from Round.
Yeah, Tim, yeah. Tim quite a lot. He's a great guy, yeah.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say he's a great guy, but we'll leave it there. he wanted to become a ref. And I was asking him, like, why? Because when I play rugby, the thing I love the most is the camaraderie with your teammates and so on and so forth. And I think being a referee can be quite a lonely experience, because you're on either side, and particularly lower levels, it's usually just you.
JB, you can say it because everyone hates you. It's fine.
Well, I mean, I always make the effort to make sure I know the referee's name and basically everything I can possibly do. Not because I care, because I want to influence him.
It can be a lonely place. You sit in the dressing room, it's 2 o'clock on a Saturday, it's an hour for kickoff. You're there an hour early because you're respecting the game, and only four players are there from the opposition. Three of them are smoking behind the sheds. And it can be a bit of ramshackle. Yeah. But when you get on the pitch, you're not asking the guys to like you. You're just hoping that they work with you, like a working relationship for the next 2 hours. And then afterwards, a lot of the time when you don't like the ref, you don't like the shirt. You don't like that guy who's stopping me being offside, or that guy stopping me pinching the ball, or whatever it may be. But you understand his role. You don't like the opposition for the 80 minutes you play them, but you understand their role. And then afterwards, you kind of have an armistice. You just relax and get into it. And you might have a beer with the ref. You might not, but a lot of people do, or the Alakadoos might. And that's where the social interaction comes. And whether you're refereeing Premiership for 10 years or you're refereeing level 8 for 10 years, you're going to see the same players over and over again. Yes. And that's where you build a relationship. And the one thing that's very different for, I guess, players and the ones I speak to quite a lot, and fans and coaches, players don't remember what game you refereed them in. Unless you did a really big game and there was a big moment, they might remember, oh, he was in that game. But generally, if you're refereeing them over a period of time, they remember how you treated them. Were you rude? Were you dismissive? Were you arrogant? Were you difficult? Or were you trying to work with them? Were you trying to talk to them? Were you trying to help them if they were confused by what's happening on the pitch? And how you treated them is your legacy, not how good of a ref you are or how bad of a ref. Coaches will have a different take on it, of course, because that's their job. And fans will remember, for example, you can referee a club and they can win 10 games on the bounce. they'll only remember the 11th game they lost, yeah, or the first game out of those 10 games in a row that they lost. That's, you're associated with the negative, and that's perfectly fine. That's the role, and that's grand. But players, they're hard pushed to say, oh, we lost that round 12 game 4 years ago with you. That was 36-12. They don't remember that. They just remember, oh, you used to ref me in my career and you were a terrible guy, or you were not the worst. I
think was the best. Well, that kind of leads me into my next question, which is, do you ever think about your style of reffing? Because I think of certain referees and they've got a very distinct style. So I always think, say, I think Matt Carley is a very precise referee. And obviously, yeah, people talk about Wayne Barnes and his communication. And there's lots of different styles. Are you aware that you might have a style?
Yeah, I think you work on it, and you work on your strong bits of your style, and you work on the weak bits of your style. It's very hard to say, well, you know, I want to be a referee where there's loads of ball in play or whatever, because you're not fully in control of that. Mm. But if you're a referee who says, right, what I'll do is I'll always be on top of the breakdown, and as best I can, I'll inform the player that there might be the tackler in the way, so don't go for that ball, because that's not coaching, that's information. You might tell the guard as the ruck moves, just take a step there, please. That's not coaching, that's information. And you say, well, I want to be the type of referee that lets the players have all the information they need to make the best decisions. And from there, you know, as you guys say on your show, let them play.
Yeah. That's interesting. So where do you draw the line between information and coaching? Because there's a very famous clip of James Haskell saying, sir, with the old foxing in Italy. And the ref said, sorry, I'm not your coach. Yeah. What's the distinction?
It's really difficult. I think if you're giving information that a coach would get, I remember I did a game once, and Exeter, Rob Baxter got a bit grumpy with me, fairly enough, and we chatted about it a week later, that as a player came through, he wasn't allowed to X or Y. He wasn't allowed to pick the ball up, and he wasn't. So I told him to kick it. He kicked it through the ruck and went running after it. And I realized, as I said to him, geez, he wouldn't have done that unless I told him to. That's, JP, that's coaching.
Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it?
You kind of learn from your mistakes, and you'll have set phrases and set information that you can give out, because it's your job to be neutral. It's your job. Your job is to keep an eye on what's fair and unfair, and that includes you as the referee. You need to make sure that you keep an eye on yourself, that you're being as fair as possible throughout the game, which is, trust me, it's more difficult than it sounds to keep that balance all the time, to remember what happened in the fourth minute is as important as the 76th minute.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, I mean, I've never really thought of that, but if you're in a ruck and, for instance, I've got my hands all over the ball, even the fact that you've said hands away, or you've given me some information to make me change my mind, where otherwise I would have given away a penalty. Well, if I'm the opposition player, I might be fairly angry with that, because I want the penalty.
Correct, but if the player, as he's going for the ball, the ruck has formed to his left and he can't see it, and it's simultaneous as he wants to go for the ball, and you're saying, geez, I don't think this player knows that information. So you shouldn't just say hands away. We do say hands away, but that's the abbreviated version. The long version is hands away. The ruck's already been formed by these two guys over there.
Yeah.
But if you said that, it would take forever, and doing it with your heart rate at 160 while running around at high speed is, well, medium speed in my case, but it's more difficult. So we do have these abbreviations, but the abbreviations are there for a reason. And in our reviews, they keep an eye on how many times we speak at the breakdown. They say you spoke 16 times the breakdown, but what's more important is you spoke nine times to the black team and only six times to the green team.
How interesting.
And like, oh, right, okay, well, is that because they competed more? No, actually, they both had the same amount of jackal attempts. Oh, right, so why was I giving so much information to one team and not another? So to keep an eye on the game on that, you really have to be careful with your words, because every word we say on the pitch, because of the microphone, we are liable for.
Yeah, I mean, could you put it down to good captaincy, the reason that you're talking to one team more than the other? The right questions?
Maybe sometimes, because it's not questions. It can be to do with speed of ball. It can be to do with the way the game is going, the weather, how many jacklers, what type of team it is, what the score it is. There's a million factors that go into every game. And that's why it's so important to referee each game for its own merits, because they change. You can't, it's very hard to say, well, you could have two running teams that are playing each other 1 week, team A and team B, and they all they do is run the ball. But they know that, so they cancel each other out by having much better defence and kicking the ball down the field and chasing it. So two running teams all of a sudden become two kicking teams for their own reason. So you might have prepped to go in for one type of game, but it's a completely opposite game.
Yeah. Now, as a ref, how long does it take you to develop the confidence that you know better than the players? Because I imagine coming up the system...
You definitely don't know better than the players. That's 100%. Well, not a chance.
Well, at some point, I mean...
How can you know better than a guy who practices his particular skill or her particular skill for years, day in, day out? And you, like, how can you know better than a prop?
Well, that'd be my next question.
All the time. You can't know better. It's impossible.
You can't, but I guess you're going to have to draw a line in the sand and either pretend or come to some sort of a combination. Because I always think, say if you've got a matchup, John Afoa against some academy kid, and John Afoa says he's doing X, Y, Z. I mean, there is a danger there that John Afoa is just pulling one over on you, because you're not going to say, hang on a minute.
100%. And John Afoa could just be sore because he played too many games, or he could have overtrained, or he could have got out of bed on the wrong side and had a creak in his neck. And the academy guy is revved up and he's been training.
Yeah, he's ready to go.
And he's just got him on two occasions. You have to treat those things absolutely uniquely each time. You might respect the guy in his position that goes, well, player A is great and player B is new, but this scrum might bring us something totally different.
Yeah.
Now, what we try and referee is the triggers that where we work with, say we do a lot of work with Neil Hatley, the England scrum coach. We have all the Premiership scrum coaches feed into my boss, Tony Spreadbury, and they give information in about, you know, so this season we're working on the gap again. So they're talking about the hooker's break foot and how changing that changes the weighting going into the scrum. So you'll hear referees using these key phrases that their coaches have told us about that they want us to look at. So it has to be a collaborative effort. It's not just us going, oh, I know all about scrum. I'm 5'5" at best and 12 stone. I know. No, that'll be nonsense.
But I mean, even the coaches, when you work them, do you ever feel that you might be being misled? To say, hey, look, we're all working on the gap, but actually they're working on something far more underhand.
Yeah, but that's up to them. That's their prerogative. It's their job to win games. It's our jobs to ensure fairness. You know, the two jobs don't meet, but we can have information. And often my boss will meet with all the Premiership coaches together. And they'll all say, well, we could get a bit quicker ball here, or we could have better scrums or better lineouts, or we need blah, blah, blah. We're too hard here. We're too soft there. And then we can referee within World Rugby rules and guidelines, everything, what our competition is telling us to referee and what they want to referee to our best effort. And then after a period of time, if we're doing it badly, they'll come back together and say, lads, you're getting it wrong. Can you do why? And that's okay too.
Okay, so let me just give you a scenario. Say you are refereeing the breakdown and there is a jackler there, jackler steals a ball, but for whatever reason it is, you deem it illegal, you blow the whistle, jackler gets up and then explains to you what he was doing, and it becomes apparent that maybe you were wrong.
Yeah.
How as a referee do you deal with that? Do you just file it away?
No, you just go. What you do is you tell them the view you had. You hear referees talking about painting pictures. So I might say, player X, let's name Neil Back, a retired player. I saw you with your forearms on the ground and then you were cleared back on the ball. And he said, no, I didn't. I touched the ground, but I brought myself back. And you're like, right. And then you look at the screen and he's right. But the picture he painted was poor in the beginning because if he wants to steal the ball or say clear release, he thinks he clear released the tackler on the ground. But you don't see it. The clear release is you have to show the referee clear release. That could be 1 inch. That could be 1 meter of release. But the referee has to see it because you have to allow the guy to place the ball. So it's important the pictures you paint for the referee, because it works both ways. Whatever works one way will work for his team in opposite.
So a quick question on that then, a little geeky technical question. Does it work when you clap after the... after the tackle's made, to show the referee that you've released?
Well, it does, because in effect, you are showing you have clear release. I think that came from the Kenyans on the Sevens.
I think it might as well, actually.
Years ago, I think, you know, in my own rugby geekiness, I think that's where I saw that coming from. I think the big thing around clear releases, as they bring the player to the player who stays on his feet as he brings the player to ground, has to show he's no longer part of the tackle. But the guys are brilliant at it now. These guys practice these skills all the time. They're unbelievably good at what they do.
Yeah.
But sometimes they can be just unaware that from the angle they are, the referee can't quite see their release. That's why it's an unfair practice.
So you must have to be very conscious or work very hard that after you've got something wrong and you realise you've got something wrong, that you either say, look, I'm going to deal with that later, and almost not to subconsciously try and even it up in some way.
And so you have to have a strategy going into games, knowing you're not... Are you going to get everything right? No, you're not. You're 100% not. And you're going to look at the screen, and if you're at Premiership grounds, and you're going to see every penalty gets replayed on the screen at a Premiership ground. So that's pretty tough going for anyone who did a job. If every decision you made in work was replayed in front of everybody every single time. And that's just the parameters we work with. That's fine. But you go, right, I didn't get that one right. Why didn't I get it right? What do I do next about it? How do I deal with that? And I've had incidents. If you get the wrong decision, if you get a certain decision wrong, the ramifications can be bigger, because the wrong decision might mean, well, it's a wrong decision, plus it's on a line break, plus it's an opportunity to score. So that means it's a yellow card, or plus X and Y means it's a penalty try. So a wrong decision can get exacerbated. So that's why we need a bit of luck. If the ones you get wrong, you hope have no impact on the game. But that's where luck comes into it, because you're making the best decision you can as often as you can. And you're training and you're reviewing and you're getting coached and you're working yourself and you're prepping going into games. But you're doing all that to reduce the amount of problems and errors and issues you have. It's not, you can't get to zero. The standard deviation can't be zero on that.
It's a very similar question, so I apologise for that. But on the counter side, can you think of any clear examples where you've made a decision under pressure from a player to his advantage? So, you know, when a player's clearly pulled the wall over your eyes for whatever reason.
Yeah, but like, that's almost a skill in itself. If you can do that, if you can pull off the ultimate con job, well,
so be it.
It does happen. Like, I don't know, one of the first games I ever refereed was an A-League game at Wasps, and Lawrence Delalio was playing, and he patted me on the head. He patted me on the head after a penalty and went, just pat, you're doing grand, lad. And I didn't know. I was just stunned. I didn't know what to do. I was being patted on the head by Lawrence Delalio. Like, not as in, like, literally on, like pop, pop on the top of my head. And I was like, I really don't know what to say to that.
No, what do you say? Well, I guess it's like whoever ref the ball.
I just had an out of, you know, you kind of got, you pretend you're looking in from the sideline. You look at that ref. He's just got tapped on the head, on the top of the head, not the back of the head or as a well done thing. Like, because he's so tall and I'm so small, he just popped me on the top of the head. I was like, fair enough.
It reminds me of the ref who did the World Cup final for England-Australia when England won it. And what was the, you know, he basically got a little speech off Jason Leonard about how good Jason Leonard was at scrimmaging, and then went and scrimmaged away. I think that must be the same sort of thing. I mean, what do you say?
Yeah, look, there is, like in any job in the world, if you are seen as the best practitioners, you probably get subconscious leeway. And you just have to try and block that out. You walk into someone who's an ideas man in work in a creative environment, whatever idea comes up on, people.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Say it isn't that brilliant, but if you stand back and go, hold on, that one wasn't so good.
Yeah,
it's the same as refereeing a great player, and there are great players out there. You can recognize them. If you're refereeing Johnny Wilkinson, he's a great player, you know that. But Johnny Wilkinson could make an illegal tackle, or Johnny Wilkinson could come up wide. So you have to try and acknowledge the potential in your mind to be leaning one way or the other, and then say, I need to be in the middle of this.
Now, there is good evidence out there that home teams get an advantage from referees, or the red or the green, or whatever it is. Have you ever been intimidated by a crowd?
No, the crowd is just ambience. It's just wonderful. Like it adds to the moment. To be honest, a lot of the time when the crowd do something, it's in reaction to a decision you've already made. So it's already done and dusted.
That's a good point, actually.
But you know, if you're at a place with 60,000 and the stand is quite close to the pitch, and you make decision X and they believe it should have been Y, that's fine. There's no problem there. They could be right. You could be wrong. Who knows? And they are booing and hissing and chanting, and you're in France or you're in somewhere in the West Country, and but the decision's already made. You've already done it. So it's not as influential as you think it might be.
Yeah, so there's no part of you when it goes on the big screen and you've got to review it. Did the shoulder make contact with the head first, head neck area first?
Yeah, just you're always, look, you come through as a referee, you learn your craft, your trade, you try and not be awful. Try and improve as you go along and be the best you can. But when you're making decisions off the screen, that's a whole different set of skills, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're now instead of my decisions going up on the screen, okay, did he roll away, was he offside, whatever it may be, you're now, you stand there while the whole crowd stand with you, looking at you, making a decision either for or against their team. And then the same around the world, if it's a game that's on telly and it's in England or the UK or it's in Europe or it's in the world or it's even, you know, it's global. So you make a decision. It's a global clip. It goes on the rugby websites as a global clip. He said it instead of and here. Isn't that where he made his mistake? That is difficult. It's a difficult skill.
Now, just on the whole thing about crowds too and stadiums. I mean, I assume that you guys are all, you're all blooded in a very sensible way. So by the time you get to international, you know, you're ready for it and you're not overawed. So how do you deal with the nerves of a big game? Because I'm sure it's still quite a frightening prospect, particularly if it's your first one.
Yeah, I think I have talked about this and thought about it quite a lot. One of the differences, we don't have to do a physical execution of skill. So let's say you're really nervous scrum half, you know you've got to make 60 passes and 10 tackles in the game or whatever it may be. If you're a kicker, you've got to kind of have to kick 4 out of 7 kicks a goal or do the kickoffs, or your hooker, your line out throwing. There's a physical skill involved that nerves makes it, you know, you've got to settle into the game. Refereeing, you might mentally jump too quick and the first two penalties are too quick. That can happen, but there's an easier adjustment there than perhaps players would go through, if that makes sense.
Because yeah,
it's a cognitive skill. Yeah, we do run around, and if you're me, you get run over quite a lot. But generally, it's a cognitive based skill rather than physical. There's physical elements to what we do, but it's a cognitive outcome.
Do you think refereeing's getting harder?
That's subjective, isn't it? What do you think?
Yes, 100%.
I don't say that facetiously. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no. I think it's getting much. I think there's two elements to it, isn't there? I think referees are getting a lot more guidance as to the outcome that the authorities want. So the high tackle decision tree, or whatever that's called, that's quite a nifty piece of
framework.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that's pretty nifty because it gives you a really good indication of what you need to do. On the other hand, you know, if you were refereeing, say, 15 years ago, when it was still a bit of the Wild West, you could throw a punch, this, that, and the other, maybe that was easier because you didn't have to be quite as accountable as you are now.
Yeah, and someone was asking me about this the other day. Like, so the best example I can say is the difference between football refereeing and rugby refereeing. And I probably won't give you the example you think I might. So, for example, in football refereeing, you're running up the pitch and the right winger has the ball, the right full forward has the ball, and he gets brought to ground, tackled, either legitimately or not. Every player who's on that pitch is looking to where the ball is on the pitch. They'll have an opinion on whether that player was fouled or not.
Yeah.
And you're the left back and the goalkeeper. You can have an opinion on that. And you probably have a decent opinion because you understand what it is. You have a clear line of sight and you can see it. In rugby, when I blow my whistle, a lot of people who believe I'm right won't actually have seen what I'm talking about. So you'll say, in the side, number 7, whatever it may be, whatever decision you can think of, offside 13, there might only be 2 or 3 players who are aware that the offence, 2 or 3 players on the pitch are aware of that offence actually taking place. Now, more viewers at home might see it because the camera's focused on it or whatever else. So players automatically just react to the whistle. It's just like Pavlov's dogs. They just automatic whistle goes, I got to go back 10 metres or we got to get on the attack or whatever it may be. Where in football, if you want to go talk to the referee, he's not where the ball is. So you have to run to him.
Yes.
Right. So if you ever hear Brian O'Driscoll talk about being captain from the 13 spot on the pitch, he found it very difficult because even if he wanted to go in and tell the referee he wanted a shot at goal, he had to run over to him. And that can look either like you're complaining or it's aggressive or it's very. And if you walk over, you might be too late before someone taps and goes and it's the wrong decision. Or if the decision's against you, you're running in from 13 when you're meant to be going back 10. So there's a lot of talk about, well, it's very hard to captain rugby outside of the numbers 1 to 9.
Well, rightly so.
Well, 1 to 8 maybe, not 1 to 9. But there is a fundamental difference in the sports. Now, you can say, well, you know, they're nicer to rugby refs than they are to soccer refs. But I think that's the biggest difference between the two. Is the fact that football has fairly basic rule structure, tackling, you either bring him down or you bump him or you don't. Like, there's only so much you can do, where rugby has a very complex structure that's quite difficult for the uninitiated to know.
Yeah, it is.
So people will go with decisions and kind of go, okay. And even people who've been watching rugby for a long time will just say, yeah, that seemed the right decision. I'm okay with that, even if they're not fully aware of what the decision is and they see the game progressing. Where in football, everyone viewing can, and if you look at Match of the Day, half a Match of the Day is taken up with talking about the referee's decisions because everybody can have an opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good point about the distance of the ref, and something which I've never really considered. You mentioned the uninitiated there. Do you ever feel that you've got a responsibility to explain the laws of the game, not only to the players, but to the viewing public? Because, of course, a lot of people who watch international rugby haven't got the foggiest idea what is going on.
I think it's complex, difficult, isn't it? Because if you're talking as much as I am on this show, for example, it's bloody annoying to listen to me telly blabbering on about stuff people don't care about. But at the same time, if you don't give them enough information, they're not following your decisions. The best referee decisions aren't the right ones. They're the ones where people go, yeah, I understand that. I follow it. I might have done something different. I think he could have done this, but I understand. And a lot of times in rugby, there might be 2 or 3 legitimate outcomes for a decision. It's not just, well, it should have been X or it should have been Y. You'll have people saying, well, I think it could have been 2 yellow cards. I think it could have been none. I think he could have played on, you know, and everyone has a reasonable argument. But if you can follow why the referee made his decisions, I'm putting you in the bin on this penalty because I've warned you before on the previous one, and that had an effect on the game, so that's why this player is going to the bin. Players go, oh, I'm glad he explained that because I thought it was just for that one-off innocuous offside. So I think that's where explanations help, but at the end of the day, people don't watch the game to listen to me and my silly Irish accent talking.
That's it. So, yeah, that's interesting. And I always think, is there a role for Premiership referees or indeed international referees to take the role of NFL officials, turn on their mics to the stadium to explain a big decision, for instance, a red card decision or a, maybe not penalty decision because they're too frequent. But there again, The NFL but refs are explaining every decision.
Red cards be the easiest decisions that don't need explanation. You just see it on the screen. And you go, well, that guy's sent off.
Yeah, that's. No. I don't know actually. There are some great examples of referees breaking down decisions. You think that is bloody brilliant because they've gone back a couple of phases and they've explained that the tackle height has gone up and then there's no covering tackler. Yeah, I actually think it, sometimes it's quite obvious, but other times it isn't always the case.
Yeah, I think you then have to have a feel for those moments, and the better referees will have a better feel for those moments, and they'll prove it time and again under pressure that they can make sensible, followable decisions. And as long as your explanation matches the picture on the screen, then the decision is up to you. There might be more than one outcome, but your words have to match the screen. That's the skill. That's the difficulty. And saying, right, I need to calm down. Look at this. Wipe what I saw on the pitch. Don't look, not what I saw, thought I saw. I need to see what's on the screen. What evidence do I have? And let's make a good decision from this point on.
Now, I'm just going to change the subject slightly. We chatted by text on Sunday, and I hope you don't mind me bringing this up. But one of the highlights of the Wasps game, well, certainly for the commentary team, was your interaction with Blair Cowan. You weren't particularly happy with yourself, though.
Yeah, the whole thing is Blair's a wonderful guy, and he was just, he didn't understand a certain thing. And as I re-explained it to him, he wasn't happy. And I should have communication's two ways, right? And maybe it can be received better, but it can always be conveyed better.
Yeah.
And if you look at that, I didn't convey perfectly. I didn't. There was a way in which I could have kept my word per minute slower. I could have been calmer. I could have kept my body language better. I could have made it better for him. So the outcome was the correct outcome, but perhaps I could have been more helpful to the outcome. And that's all it is. It's looking, it's their game. It's not for me. Why would I want to get annoyed at what's happened on the pitch? So it's their game. It's not my game. Who am I to behave in a way that is not, that's the way I want to be spoke to on the pitch.
See, so I find
it might only be a word or two, and no one else might notice it, but I might notice it, and I think I can convey better than that.
Yeah, I found that fascinating because I actually really like that moment because it was genuine. You're not the sort of referee that likes to wisecrack every 5 minutes. And, we can talk about that another time. And also the commentary team liked it because it was kind of a little bit unexpected. And I think it's a really healthy attitude that you have, which is, actually, no, I should have conveyed myself better. And, what could I do to improve it? Now, as it happens, I think it's a very entertaining moment for everyone.
But it's just about, it shouldn't be about the ref.
Yes, completely.
No moments in the game that should be about the ref. It should be about the guy in the yellow jersey. That's fine. But it shouldn't be about the ref. And the best moments I have on the pitch are said very low, you can't hear them on the mic, they're a giggle, they're a look, they're an expression with someone. They're the best moments. The best moments isn't having a wisecrack at someone and making them feel bad. Like, why would you want to do that? I don't understand, but that's fine. That's just not the way I'd want. You can have fun with the players. When a player cracks a joke with you, you can laugh and have a nice time. But you don't need to be wisecracking and making anyone feel bad on the pitch.
Well, all I'm going to say is it was entertaining, but I do completely get your point of view and where you're coming from there. The future of refereeing, if you had your way, how would you change it?
We wouldn't have to wear those cameras anymore. Look like SpongeBob SquarePants running around the pitch. How would I change it? I think refereeing is irrelevant. It's what's the future of the game, and how does the game want our role to look in that? Like, how good can we make rugby? Refereeing is irrelevant. Refereeing is only there to make sure the game is played fairly. So what's rugby going to look like in 10 years? If you go back and watch the 2003 World Cup, that England and Australia final, it's extraordinarily fast, but in a totally different type of way. And if you look at the play that led up to the Jason Robinson score in the corner, you look at the running off the ball, the sp- speed, you know, if Johnny goes right and Cone goes in on the sticks, it's a different game, isn't it? But that whole build up to all of that, the speed and power is there, but it's a different type of speed and power to this game we have now. And the athletes, like, I was watching a game the other day, you see players making 40-yard breaks now and then accelerating again. That's what kind of athletes you have on the pitch. They're phenomenal. So where is rugby going to go? Well, that'll affect where refereeing's going to go.
Yeah, I don't know. It's got sort of chicken and the egg scenario. There's two ways about it. Officiating is affecting the game. I don't think it's always for the positive. Or at least if there is a negative side to it, it's to counteract... No, sorry. There can often be a positive side, but it's counteracted by a negative side. I'll give you an example, the TMO. I'm much happier that more correct decisions will be made, but am I happy about the delays in the game? No, not particularly.
Yeah, it's the genie's out of the bottle there. What do? You know, you want to get as many correct decisions. We're coming into the last 2 weeks of the World Cup now, so we want the players to win these next, well, three games and the bronze medal games. There's four games left. We want the players to win those games. We're desperate. I can tell you any match official who's appointed or TMO is appointed to those games is lying in their bed, desperate the night before, that it's won by the players. That this is completely won by the players. And everyone goes, wasn't player X fantastic? It's the fear and the goal at the same time.
But let me pose you this question then. Do you think it's a shame that we'll never see another win like the Leicester win against Munster in the Heineken Cup final when Neil Back knocks the ball out of Peter Stringer's hands? Because that is a player win.
Well, as a Leinsterman, I guess there's been so many incidents. But that, you know, that's in folklore as well. But that was still 7 or 8 minutes to go in the game. That wasn't the last play of the game, so...
Was it not? There'll
always be incidents in the game that people look and go, if this penalty had gone this way, or that decision had been that, or this card, or lack of card. So you're going to still have controversial moments. You look at VAR in football, they still have controversial moments. Match of the day, as I said, it's still taken up by controversial refereeing decisions, because that's the nature of the sport. It's just this. It's such a complex game, rugby. I can't see how we won't have talking moments. Now they could, like, the moments could be completely correct by the match officials, but they're still talking moments. My God, player X did something good, bad, indifferent, foul play, or wonderful play, and that was the difference. And could the ref have done X there? Yeah, he could have. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I there's some part of me that's very sad that we can't see overt cheating, which the ref missed.
Yeah. Yeah, like the 91 World Cup with Blanco and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It could never happen now.
But the game is extremely physical, extremely fast. You know, it's just played at a million miles an hour now. And there's when was the last time you saw a punch on the rugby pitch? It's very, very, very rare.
Well, I mean, you just couldn't get away with it.
Yeah, it's very rare. And what happens at the top level affects all the other levels. So if you were to go down to National 2 or Level 5, Midlands 1 or London 1, whatever it may be, there is less violence than there was X years ago.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's funny you mentioned that. I was actually thinking about this either yesterday or the day before, which was when I was going from youth team rugby to senior rugby, you know, like when you're 19 or 18 or whatever it was, it was a genuinely terrifying prospect, because you see these massive blokes punching each other somewhere in North Wales. And now, if I was to do it again, I think it'd be a completely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, it's like rugby league used to scare the life out of me. I was like, why would you want to play that game? It's just everybody running into each other.
it was genuinely terrifying. Now, you get no violence in it now, which is actually good for players like me who are not particularly violent. But there again, you also miss something from it too.
Well, yeah, we'll kind of leave that one out there.
Now, obviously, I don't want you to give me any names of teams. But do you have certain matchups or certain teams that you really enjoy reffing just because you know what they're going to bring?
Yeah, but they evolve. Like, again, you would have thought 3 years ago was the top game in the league is now not the top league. You know, it's replaced by somebody else.
Yeah,
there are the rivalries that pop up and disappear, depending on the fortunes of teams. Sometimes great rivalries can disappear through relegation, or they, you know, there was years ago at level five when you, the likes of Richmond and Scottish and, you know, loads of teams in level five playing each other as rivalries. It can evolve. Like the big game is the big game of the day, and what that is can change very quickly. Like if I was to ask you in the Premiership, what were the big games 2 years ago and what are the big games now? I doubt they're the same games.
Yeah, you're
in football.
To be fair, you're
football,
absolutely right.
Man U Liverpool is probably always going to stay as one of the biggest games, isn't it?
Well, Tottenham,
Arsenal and Man U, Man City, and you know they're the big games, aren't they? And they haven't changed ever.
I guess the test of that theory would be, what happens to the games involving Leicester in the next few years? Is Leicester-Northampton still going to be a big game? Is Leicester-Bath still going to be a big game? Because obviously Leicester aren't the force that they once were, but does that rivalry still endure?
But we don't know, because they've only played one game.
Yeah.
We don't know. The game of the day is going to be the game of the day, and you guys on your show were looking into week one. Oh my God, I can't believe this team is playing this team, and how big of a game is that? Who would have thought that? Or we would have thought these two would have been a good big game, but not quite the interest this week. We prefer to see. You see in the NFL, they do a thing called flex in the NFL.
Yes, so they flex the games, don't they?
Yeah, they'll slate. We're going to put on New York Giants versus the Jets, and it's a derby game in the Meadowlands, and they're having a great time. They go, actually, no, they're both garbage. They're both 0-4. So we're going to show you, we're going to go to the 49ers versus the Broncos because they're on a winning record. And that wouldn't have been a big game 4 weeks ago, but it is now, and they just flex in and out of them. So rivalries do change, I think.
Yeah. Now, when it's all said and done, and you hang up your whistle, is there any game in particular?
Is that a hint?
Not at all, JP. Not at all. Is there any club game in particular that you want? That you want to do, or are you fairly happy that if it all finished tomorrow, you've achieved everything you want to do?
I guess it's a bit like asking someone, are they happy with their salary? You know, they might be happy with their salary, but they wouldn't say no to one more dollar, one more pound, one more bonus. And I think everybody wants to do another big game and another big game. And why would you ever be satisfied that you've done them all? Because the next game is still the biggest game. So, yeah, like it's because you're proud of what you've done, but you haven't been in control of anything. You mightn't have got game X. The other guy might have got it if his team hadn't been playing and he was ineligible. Or look at the World final. Is Wayne Barnes going to do it, or England going to get there?
You know,
if England get there and Wayne never referees a World Cup final, is that a slight on Wayne? Well, no, because he had no control over it. So You want to do big game, but you're the ref. You're not important. Someone else will ref it if you don't.
yeah, it's true. Graveyards are full of indisposable men.
Yeah, well, every team in every game has everyone's replaceable. There's nobody who's not like you hear a lovely saying, "Oh, we need the refs for the game. Be nice to ref," and that's lovely. But as long as we have the numbers to referee, which is so important, don't consider yourself too important because someone else can do that game.
Yeah. Now, this is probably going to be my last question. I've literally just thought of it now. But has there ever been a refereeing performance where you've thought, wow, that is seriously impressive? Because I have one which I've just thought of now, which actually, you say the referee wasn't the main person involved. I think in this case, he was, and rightly so. And that was the performance of Wayne Barnes in the last 20 minutes after full time between France and Wales. I thought awesome.
He did brilliant, and he really knew his regulations as far as what we could replace, who we couldn't replace, how we could replace them, what time on, could the guy come back out of the bin, was the clock running. But the whole thing, why that was 21 minutes, the only people knew is because that particular TV company kept the clock running from 80 minutes up, where a lot of clocks might count down to zero.
Oh, is that
stop
right?
At 8, and you wouldn't have known that it went to 102 minutes. It's only that particular TV company kept the clock running.
I never knew that.
Because sometimes you can have, just with penalties, and you can kick the touch now, you can get to 86, 87 minutes, no problem. With a bin and on the goal line and scrum.
Yeah.
Oh, and you saw that Wei, now that went to the nth degree, and he kept so calm and he did so well.
I thought it was amazing.
That's where he moved it. And you're not actually refereeing there because there's no ball in play. He was just managing and organizing with the French and the Welsh what props could come on, who could be replaced. Could that bin come back? Are we having a reset? Can you go uncontested? If you go uncontested, how many men are you allowed to have, even with the bin? So there was a mental agility exercise for Wayne, which he just passed so easily.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's everything which I like.
He did it brilliant. But you can look at a game now, and I dare you to start your stopwatch when it goes to 40 minutes. But you'll see players, they might have been sin-binned at 32 minutes, and they start the second half, and you're thinking, how is that possible? But there's been 2 minutes of play or 3 and 4 minutes of play before the end of the half, and he's actually done his 10 minutes in the bin, and he's back on the pitch. The game with ball in play can be unbelievable. The kickoff now, when the players are fresh, the first time you blow your whistle, because they're not kicking directly to touch anymore, might be 6 minutes.
Do you know what? I'm so glad that I asked that question, because that is insight that I would never have even guessed at.
Yeah, it's just, if you watch the BT games, it ends at 80, you know.
Right, well, do you know what? We've basically done an hour there. So I'm sure you've got many, many more games of rugby to be watching. I know it's not particularly cool or helpful for referees to be on social media, but are you on social media? Can we find you?
I am, but nobody would be bothered with getting in touch with me. There's nothing interesting. I think anything I've interesting to say, I've probably said it tonight, and that's stretching the truth as it is. But hopefully we've given a little bit of insight.
Well, JP, that has been absolutely fascinating, and thank you so much for spending your time explaining these little nuances, which I had no idea about. It's been enlightening.
Yeah, no problem. Well, we hope not to ruin too many games for you in the future.
Fantastic. Thanks, mate.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.